Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning, and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about my favorite subject, taste. Actually, we have a conversation about many different subjects, all of them related to taste or food in some way. And today, we're really excited to have with us, all the way in Bushwick, Brooklyn, sitting next to a little pizzeria that could, Yotam Ottolenghi and Sami Tamimi, who you may know as proprietors and chefs of the great Ottolenghi restaurants in London, and or takeout shops in Nopi, their restaurant in London, but who are here because of their beautiful new book called Jerusalem, which is a mouth-watering compendium of recipes and stories and articles about some things you might not think of when you think of Jerusalem, which obviously is a complicated place, but you may not know that there are hummus wars going on as we speak. And so perhaps today, by the end of the show, we will have brought some peace to the Middle East, at least when it comes to hummus, because I understand that your recipe is amazing, says my friend Bonnie Stern, who has made many a hummus in her day.
If Bonnie says so, then she must be right.
I think so. That's what I believe. So welcome to the studio and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
So you guys are here in the midst of a whirlwind book tour of Canada and the United States. And rather than start with the book, which you're probably sick about talking about, tell me about some of your impressions of the food people you've met and the audiences that have received you here. I heard that your book has already made it onto the Times bestseller list. So clearly you are celebrities here in America, even if people haven't really had your food. The chances are they haven't been to your restaurants.
First of all, it's news to us that we are we got this sort of title. It's just lovely to be able to get this sort of very, very warm reception. You know, we in Europe, we're very cynical.
Yes.
And here in North America, nobody is. So we get all these lovely receptions and meals and book signings, and everybody's very positive. And we didn't even know we were so popular. So that's...
We realize how many people actually know Ottolenghi, and a lot of them they've been as well.
Yeah,
was Sami. It's funny too, because often words that are hard to pronounce, names that are hard to pronounce, have some resistance here in America. You know, I'm surprised they didn't make you call yourselves Otto or something.
Otto's.
Yeah, there's a pizzeria to contend with.
Yeah, no, that's true. But more seriously, it is really, really sort of quite very, very refreshing reception. Everywhere we go, people seem to sort of warm up to the food for what we represent. And I think it is also probably has to do with the fact that a Jew and an Arab walk together in the streets of Toronto and sort of cook nice food and make everybody feel very happy.
Of course. So let's talk about that. I have to ask you some questions that I'm sure everyone has asked you. How did you guys meet? How did you end up in business together? And what brought you to this place?
I mean, let's tell the story from the beginning.
Yeah, I think
we were born in the same year, 68,
in
the same place in two different parts of Jerusalem. I was born in the east, and Yotam was born in the west of Jerusalem.
See, and I was born in 68 too, but the two cultures that came together were New Jersey and Brooklyn.
Quite a lot of similarities.
Yeah.
There was no war that brought New Jersey and Brooklyn together, was there?
No. Although there might have been one in our house, but anyway.
We moved to Tel Aviv the same year. And then,
which we're still debating if it was.
But this is before you knew each other.
91.
Yeah, no. Let's just make that clear.
We never met. And in Tel Aviv, we had friends that we shared, but we never actually met. And we moved to Tel Aviv to London in the same year.
Coincidentally.
97.
Yeah, so it's kind of a bit freaky.
And 2 years later, 1999, I went for I went for a job and I went to hand in my CV at a place called Baker and Spice, which you know of.
I know the Baker and Spice in Dubai. Yeah, we talked about it on the show. Yeah,
that was in Chelsea in London, and I came in with my CV. And the only person of authority that I noticed when I walked in was Sammy. He was the head chef. And I said to him, is there a manager here? Because I want to get a job as a pastry chef. And he said, well, the manager is not around. You can give me the CV. I gave him my CV. And then we started talking. And we got talking about London, about the food, about this and that. It only took about 10 minutes before we realized that actually we were both from Jerusalem. We could just not speak English, but speak Hebrew if we wanted.
Funny.
And that we had this sort of parallel path to this very moment. We same year moving to London, same year we were born, and sort of everything came to fruition at that very crucial moment.
So when did you go from that encounter to opening a restaurant? How long, into your friendship?
We worked together at Bacon Spice for 2 years. Different section. I was doing all the savory and Yotam was doing all the pastry. And then Yotam decided that he wants to open his own place, so he left and started looking for the perfect site. And then a few months later, I joined Ottolenghi, and we had the first shop in Notting Hill in London.
And let's describe, since people might not know it and they know your work, the shop, because when I stumbled on it the first time, I remember writing back that, oh my God, I found a place that I wish I could eat lunch in every day in New York. And I happen to work across the street from City Bakery, which is one of the closest, I think, in concept. But there was something so alive and fresh and beautiful about the retailing as much as the food. So describe the store a little bit for folks.
I think in hindsight, it's sort of we only understood it like looking back, and it's also relevant to the book, that it looks like a Middle Eastern souk. You know, there's piles of food. And I don't think, if I say piles of food, I don't think it evokes quite the right kind of image.
Platters, because, we might say, piled onto platters. Yeah.
But also, you know, the colors and the textures. And the minute you walk in.
The idea of abundance.
These are big platters piled up with loads and loads of beautifully prepared fresh food with tons of colors, very generous in terms of the use of herbs and contrasting colors. And the platters themselves are very beautiful. Both Sami and myself are sort of obsessive collector of platters that fit and suit our food. And it's all built up quite high. So there is this sort of sense of almost like a mountain, beautifully looking mountain of food. And opposite there is a parallel elaborate pastry stage. Mm-hmm. And those together are what we became quite famous for, the pastry counter, the savory counter, and everything in between. And so the essence of the business is food to go, but food to go in a very sort of a glamorous, beautiful, vivacious kind of environment.
Well, it works. I'll just thinking about it is making my mouth water right now, I have to say. And so you have how many shops in London?
We have 4 shops. Mm-hmm. And recently, almost a couple of years ago, we opened another restaurant, which is sort of deviates from the formula. It's called Nopi. It's more like a glamorous brasserie in London, Soho.
Right, with a pretty elegant dining room, and then you get the fun part downstairs. You kind of eat in the kitchen or the storeroom or something. Yeah,
it's an open kitchen, and you can actually experience the whole shouting and noise and the smells.
And also it's the larder, you know, it's where the chefs keep all their dry stores. And so, it's a sort of incorporated into the real sort of hive or the center of the restaurant.
Yeah.
And so this is the third book to come out of this food. I mean, I'll call it an empire, but it's
it's a very small empire.
In America, we like big words and big ideals, big dreams. The first book was Ottolenghi, which sort of was a real distillation of the food that you serve in the restaurants. The second one was called Plenty, which was vegetarian. So everyone, that was, I think, how first Americans came to know you, North Americans came to know you.
Correct.
And thought you were a vegetarian restaurant and only cooked vegetarian food.
And then they came to London and noticed there's some food, some meat, and some people got a bit angry, but then they ate the salads and they were all happy again.
Right.
Maybe you need to tell them a little bit about the whole column.
There's the Guardian. So the way the books, I mean, the first book was, like you said, Mitch, it's the food of Ottolenghi. So it was, we sort of decided to, that it would be a good idea to take the things that we've cooked for the public over the first sort of 5 years and turn them into a cookbook. And that has proven very popular. And then I've been writing a food column for The Guardian since 2006. That was a vegetarian column. Now it's a sort of a semi-vegetarian column. And all those recipes that I wrote for The Guardian ended up in Plenty. And that was the first book that got an American edition. And
so why did a carnivore write a column on vegetarian food?
The answer is because I had no other option.
Okay, that's a good answer. This is what we want from you. This is what you're going to give us.
He tried different ways, but then they wouldn't have any of it.
Felicity, our agent, said to me, you know, she said, The Guardian offers you to write a vegetarian column. And I said to her, Felicity, I don't want to do a vegetarian column. She said, beggars can be choosers. Just do what they tell you, and then you can.
Okay.
In the future, you might be able to negotiate. Your price may go up, and yet, and then you can demand a little bit more. But in actual fact, it was a wonderful challenge. And I think what I was worried about is that, you know, in the world of food, vegetarianism is way, 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 way lower. With a sort of in the snobbish world of chefs, of restaurant chefs. And this has really changed, actually, over the last 5 to 8 years, where you go to very serious restaurants that take their vegetarian foods extremely serious.
Even vegetables, seriously, let alone vegetarian food.
Exactly, yeah. Even vegetables. A place like the Ledbury in Notting Hill, 3 Michelin stars, way up in the list of the best restaurants in the world, and they have a serious section of only vegetables. But that was not the case back then, and I was a little bit worried about being pigeonholed as a vegetarian food writer. And I think, I don't know if I have anything to do with it, but over the last 5 to 8 years, things have been really changing and happening. And with Plenty, I think all of a sudden people noticed that actually it could be a vegetarian cookbook, and it could be extremely excited, and the food doesn't need to be gray and bland and horrible and healthy.
Wheat berries, but in a different way, not that loaf that we all know from the 70s.
All those terrible loaves and meat substitutes and, you know, and stacks of things that you don't want to eat. And at that point, when I realized that it doesn't mean I need to cook like that, I felt actually very liberated, because it means I've got the world of wonderful vegetables to cook with and play with, and that's not a problem.
I'm going to remind people listening that you can, if you have questions for our guests about vegetarian cooking, about Jerusalem, about opening a restaurant in London, whatever, the interviews in Toronto, you can email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Or if you're listening to the podcast, which many of you do, most of you do, I understand, you can tweet us at TasteMattersHRN, and we'll get your questions, if not on air this week, we can get them to you in the future. We can try to answer them in the future. So let's leap ahead, because those were your first forays into the publishing world, and very successful at that, and beautiful, mouthwatering books. And then you settled on a book on Jerusalem. And I think I want to talk about that for a couple of reasons. I mean, some of them obvious, but partly because we hear a lot in New York anyway about the sort of food revolution happening in Israel. But when you hear about it, mostly people are thinking about Tel Aviv and the great chefs there. There's a lot of, obviously a lot of people from New York visit Israel. Maybe that's not obvious, but it's obvious to some Republicans or something. I don't know. but you did not do a book on Tel Aviv.
No.
You did a book on Jerusalem. You're both from there, obviously. But what is the significance of food in Jerusalem in the bigger scheme of things?
First of all, I have to agree with you that most of the exciting stuff is actually happening in Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv is where there's sort of some kind of a revolution coming to its sort of peak now with Israeli food really starting to sort of assert its weight in terms of the use of local ingredients, and finally incorporating local, and I'm talking about, when I mean local, I don't only mean local as in ingredients, but local techniques and Palestinian food and stuff that's been there for about, you know, 300-400 years. Into modern, authentic. But we chose Jerusalem for basically a couple of very sort of selfish reasons. I mean, we were both from Jerusalem, and when we left Jerusalem, which was centuries ago, we really thought we'd never look back. You know, the Jerusalem is the sort of place you leave and you think, oh gosh, get me out of here. Now I'm never going to come back to the city, because you move. Most people our age that want to sort of experience the world, they go to Tel Aviv. They might leave Tel Aviv and go somewhere else, like London or Brooklyn. But
in droves, I understand. But yeah,
but it was you really feel like you've been saved from Jerusalem, because it's you know, it's a very, it's not an easy place to live in for all sorts of reasons. But then our friend and business partner Noam said to us, why don't you go and write a book about Jerusalem? And we said, like, why would we? And he said, because, you know, this is where it all started. You know, you both grew up in Jerusalem. This is the answer to the question, what is Ottolenghi food?
Yeah.
Because although it's not, you don't cook traditional Jerusalem food, it's where everything sort of began.
Yes. That was a very smart business partner. Smart idea. Yeah.
And Sammy, I mean, you can tell, but I think it was a real revelation for us in some ways.
When we started, it was like, okay, so the first few chat we had about it, what are we going to write? It's like, you know, it's. I know a lot of Palestinian food, but I don't really know so much of the Jewish side of cooking. There are dishes, but they're not something that you can actually write a book with.
Right.
And then the more we kind of research and dig into the whole communities, you actually find out quite a lot of, you know, really exciting things.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them, they're kind of similar to between Jewish and Palestinians.
Right.
They even call them the same name sometimes.
Yeah.
But, you know, with kind of minor changes.
And in the process of going back, I imagine you spent time there to do the book?
Time there. Sammy didn't, but quite a bit of the stuff was researching through books and researchers, and I went a few times, and it was, there were basically, we did two things. We talked to people, but we also dug back into, I mean, Sammy has a lot of memories that he had to sort of recreate, food memories from his mother's kitchen.
Yeah.
And I think that was some of the most exciting processes was trying to replicate food memories.
We're going to stop there and take a quick break for a moment. All of you listening, think of your food memories, and we'll come back with Yotam Ottolenghi and Sammy Tamimi.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today. My name is... Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking today with two really fun and engaging food people from London, I should say, Yotam Ottolenghi and Sammy Tamimi, who operate four wonderful food shops in London in a great restaurant called Nopi, and have just authored the best-selling Jerusalem, a cookbook. And it's a cookbook, it's such an evocative cookbook. I was saying to you earlier on my way to the studio, I was looking at it on a crowded subway and got a little self-conscious. It felt kind of like pornography. The pictures are so lush. It was people were hungry around me, and you could just sort of, I closed it and put it away and thought, I better do this in private. Yeah. So one of the things, I mean, you were talking about recreating food memories here, and there's a lot going on right now in New York. I've been on six panels about Jewish cuisine of some kind. Jewish cuisine, I can't even say that. It sounds funny to say Jewish food, because here it means gefilte fish. I was on a gefilte fish panel. I'm on a brisket panel. We just did a deli panel, all this sort of stuff. And I'm wondering if going back to Jerusalem, either literally or figuratively, in your memories of the food, you've seen it affected the food that you were cooking sort of in your contemporary London places, or even changed the way you thought about the food that you were doing there.
Yeah. I mean, normally the process for us is a bit different. When we embark on a book, we are completely
obsessed.
We're completely in the book, and then we have two projects: the running our business and writing a book. And they seem never to come together, because the book is a research, and we do it at home, and it's completely our books are very geared towards home cooks.
Sure.
They're not for chefs. In our minds, I mean, I'm sure
lots of chefs use them,
but it's
for, well, it's for the idea, combinations are, I think, what are the flavor combinations. The things are so sometimes surprising and delicious sounding. So
yeah,
I can see a chef being inspired by that, if not the recipes, you know, following the recipes.
But they don't follow the sort of the traditional sort of restaurant. They're sort of, I think we have in mind a home cook rather than a chef.
Yeah, they're not meant to be for restaurant cooking.
Sure. Yeah. And through this process, so we keep it quite separate, but then I think what we realize is that when we sort of get this sort of project out of the way, all of a sudden these recipes start creeping into the restaurants in different guises. So, for instance, I mean, we've already incorporated a few things from this book, but we never did it while doing it, right? It will always we keep this sort of healthy separation between the creative process for the book and what we do in the restaurants, and after it starts to sort of appear. And I'm not sure why we do that.
Well, who knows why anyone does anything, really, yeah. Ultimately.
Because I think we feel like we need to keep all the recipes of the book for the book until it comes out or until it's ready to go.
Yeah, and I think also because we test things, the recipes, so obsessively that for the book that we can't really... I mean, there is this sort of very... really obsessive is the only word I can describe about how we get attached to the recipes.
Okay.
And we test and test again. And I send it to Sammy and he sends it back to me, and I send it back to him again. I said, could we just not have 5 grams less of fenugreek in that cake? And he goes like, no way, we need that fenugreek. So it's like... And I think only when everything is sort of sound and sealed and we're all happy, that's when we start.
Okay, so what were the hard parts about working on this book? Since I imagine drumming up memories of a complicated past in Jerusalem, there must have been some things that were, either challenges to your professional relationship
Do you think there was? I don't think there was challenges to our relationship in a way.
The relationship, no, but there were challenges to creating some of the recipes, because a lot of the recipes are from memory, and although I knew how, or both of us knew how it should taste and smell, but there was no actual recipe, so you can't even go to somewhere and say, how did you do that?
Right.
And to create it, sometimes frustrating, because it took such a long time. Some of the recipe took like 6 and 7 times to trial until you get it right.
And then you know it because suddenly you have a shudder and you taste it and you are sort of situated in that place
you
or in
kind
that
of
memory.
You see, I'm getting closer, but it's not there. I'm still kind of struggling. And then when you get it right, it's like, wow, this is how it should be.
But you know, I have to say something about the going back to Jewish food and gefilte fish.
Oh,
I mean,
God.
this book is very lacking on Ashkenazi food. And I know some people would like to kill us, but we sort of wash our hands at the beginning in the introductions by saying, you know, because Jerusalem has so much food,
of course,
that we had to sort of curate it and make a choice. And the choices that we made are very much the choices of the things we like to cook and eat.
Yeah. Right.
And we don't have...
I've never been had to be more proud of Ashkenazi food than when I was in Israel, where it was maligned everywhere I went, where I was ready to roll out knishes myself just to show you they could be good, because you do sense that. And obviously, perhaps not a food made for a desert environment or a desert climate.
I think that is actually the essence of it, because when like the 30, 40, or 50 years ago, I mean, before people realize that it's not good, that it doesn't make sense, you know, in terms of where you are. There was actually a few good examples. People sort of lost the will to make good Ashkenazi food.
Yeah.
And only the cakes survived.
Yes, that is true. The babkas, the whatever. And they're very good.
They are very good.
But I single-handedly, me and my friends here in New York are going to go to Israel. We're going to do a gefilte fish festival, and we'll be alone with our...
Well, in London, we already had an event called Gefilte Fest.
Ah.
So they stole your name.
Uh-oh.
See, you shouldn't talk about it.
Yeah, okay. Shh, don't say that. I won't tell anyone. Oh, wait, we're on the air. Tell me about London and how this is received, but also just what's happening in food in London. We still, I mean, talk about fighting some bad stereotypes regarding food. I mean, even though I know you can eat incredibly well in London, there's the Ledbury, there's your places, there's so many great places to eat. There's still that perception that the food is crap and... you know, the best meal you have is on the plate on the way over.
There is quite a lot of crap around.
Yeah, here too, everywhere too. You can't say there isn't.
I mean, the changes that have happened over the last, I mean, since we arrived, we've been in London for about 15 years, are tremendous. I mean, I think in some ways it's, in the European context, it's the most exciting place because things actually happen and change. And I think London really benefits the fact that the food was so crap before.
Right.
Because there is a sense that it can only get better.
Right, and there's such leaps happening.
And there's something to, there's nothing to sort of be chauvinistic about, you know, like the French and the Germans and the Italians and the Spanish. I mean, they just wouldn't leave their old food because I guess there's some kind of justification.
But I'm not giving up my spag bog and my chicken tikka masala,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So you both shared a lot of, startling coincidences. I'm wondering if food was important in that time at home growing up in Jerusalem, if it was an important aspect of both of your lives in any way.
Yeah,
I was breastfed with food.
You were? Yeah. Interesting. I have to meet your mother. Was it?
I grew up in a house that basically cooked and eat and talked about food and cooked again and talked about food.
You also, Sammy, you should tell how you used to sneak into the kitchen because the boy was not supposed to go into the kitchen, but your mom used to push you out and then you found your back.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, I was so curious about what they do. I mean, what the hell is just going on there?
And right.
I'm really curious about looking and seeing everything and I kept kind of shushed out and say, this is not a place for a boy. You just stay out.
That's so funny.
Go and play with your friends. I mean, for me, it's kind of a natural thing. From an early age, I knew that this is what I wanted to do, just cook.
And for you, Yotam?
I grew up also in a house that had a lot of cooking going on. My father is from Italy. He was born in Italy. And hence the name.
That would explain some things, yes.
And we always had fantastic food. My grandparents left Italy in body, but not in soul. So they had sort of olive oil and pasta and salami and coffee being sent over to them. And there was always fantastic food in the house. And funny, my food is very not very un-Italian in some ways. And it's sort of I think the Middle Eastern in me sort of took the best part of my cooking.
You like your pasta.
I love my pasta. Who doesn't?
Is there anyone who doesn't like pasta?
No, but he also likes all his raviolis
and yuppies. But I think it's just that sort of sensibility that comes from my father's sort of side that really sort of...
And that cultural appreciation, I think, which is really important. That's the piece I feel like in America we're still developing. I mean, the food scene here has changed drastically in New York, but also just around the country. But the food culture is slower to build up to meet the interest and enthusiasm about food. I'm sure that's true in London too.
That is true, and also same as here. I mean, in London itself has great food. As soon as you start sort of leaving the London and going out, then it becomes much less exciting and a little bit like what you imagined before. The only good food you get is on the way there or back.
So. Right. So lastly, I think, I mean, I can't avoid this question because, you know, we all have, us food people have this fantasy that food is the ultimate peacemaker, you do think it is. Well, that's good to, that was my question. You're preempting my question. It was James Beard's famous quote was food was our common ground and that if we just sat down together, we would, you know, it would be a better place.
I think that if we just sat down together is the most important caveat here. And I think what we write in the book is that food has loads of potential to achieve that in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
But if we need to be realistic, it's not happening yet. But, you know, there is a sense that what we tried to describe in the book is that the only place where there is interaction is in markets, in restaurants, in sharing recipes. Because Jews and Palestinians, they don't go to the same schools. Normally, they don't go to the same workplace. I mean, there's hardly ever mixed couples. You know, there is very, very little mixing
together
happening.
But not together, right?
Yeah.
Like in the same place, but not together.
And with food... it looks like there could be, that could be the bridge. Right. I mean, it's not.
But there is this issue that we don't have time to really talk about, the kosher thing, which is a difficult, I mean, well, on either side.
Don't go there.
We don't want to go there.
I want to say one thing. Yeah. I think kosher is a bit of an excuse. Okay. I really think kosher is a bit of an excuse. I think there could be a lot of sharing done. I mean, after all, everybody eats the same. And the Muslims don't eat pork, and the halal slaughter is similar to kosher slaughter.
And they don't eat seafood because there's no seafood in Jerusalem.
Right. The sea is dry.
Only in our book.
Right. Right. Okay, well, we are coming to the end of a great conversation, but I would encourage everyone to pick up this beautiful book. It really does make your mouth water. Thank you both for being with us, and good luck on the rest of your tour.
Thanks, Mitchell.
Next week, we're going to be welcoming, in anticipation of Thanksgiving, actually, we have Marvin Taylor, who edited a beautiful compendium called 101 Classic Cookbooks. Marvin is the curator and chief librarian at the Fales Library at New York University, which has one of the largest private collection of cookbooks. And it's a great historical account, a very visual, beautiful book that shows all of the great American cookbooks, the classics. So tune in then. In the meantime, if you're eating something, maybe think of world peace and how we can all come together. Yes. No, this is Taste Matters.
Food peace.
Food peace. Yeah. I like that. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Heritage Radio Network is now on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and other devices with Stitcher. Stitcher is smart radio for your phone. Find it in your app store or at Stitcher.com. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.